Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Law of Code podcast. Really excited to share this episode with you today, particularly in light of what we've seen come out of the CFTC regarding Coinbase and them being announced as gaining FCM approval from the CFTC. My guest today is Michael Frisch, and Michael is a partner at Croke, Fairchild, Morgan, and Barra's, where he leads the firm's government litigation and investigations practice. Mike's experience with crypto began at the CFTC, so the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, where he brought one of the CFTC's first enforcement actions involving cryptocurrency, CFTC versus Bitfinex, which we'll talk about today, and was part of the team responsible for the CFTC's action against Tether in 2021. While at the CFTC, Mike was part of the litigation team in CFTC versus Monex, a landmark case that concerned the applicability of Section 2C2D of the CEA and contributed to the CFTC's final interpretive guidance on actual delivery for digital assets. And this will be, I think, a wide-ranging conversation, but one that is primarily focused on the CFTC, the cases that have been brought, and what the future and overview really looks like with the CFTC and crypto today. So Mike, thanks so much for joining me, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've really been looking forward to this, Jacob. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. I'm looking forward to this as well. And as we were saying, so much talk is focused on the SEC and whether or not something's a security. But as we've seen in Canada, even if something isn't a security, there could still be some rules and regulations put in place, particularly if that asset is considered to be a commodity. But before we get into all that, I thought I'd love to hear a bit about your genesis block, how you were first introduced to Bitcoin and what your story is there.
Sure. Again, thanks so much for having me. This is going to be fun. I'm not probably as experienced of a podcast guest as some of your other guests. I'll do my best. I started my career in big law. I was like more of a white collar practitioner. And then I joined the CFTC in early 2015. And one of the first cases I just got handed to me was this investigation into Bitfinex. And at the time, I didn't know what Bitcoin was. I think it was the first that I'd heard of it was when this case just got randomly assigned to me. And I remember I was still in the big law firm mentality. So I wrote this big long memo for my supervisor, what is Bitcoin? And that's really how I got into it. So at the time, the CFTC, this was 2015, and the CFTC had just taken a position in its first two enforcement actions that Bitcoin, and it really was just Bitcoin then, I think Ethereum was on the horizon too, what was a commodity, and therefore offering derivatives on top of Bitcoin was an activity that was regulated by the U.S. Commodity Exchange Act. And I can unpack all those terms and what that means and what the CFTC does. I'd be happy to do that. Ever since then, I just got really interested in crypto and learned more and became someone who read and spoke about it. And I'm a big believer in the CFTC and what we do. And I think it would be a much better regulator than the SEC in the U.S., but we can talk about that later.
Yeah, I'd love to dive into that. But just to unpack a bit about what you were doing when you were first writing this memo, you're writing, what is Bitcoin? What did that look like? I can imagine it took a while to put that together. But once that was submitted, what happened after that in terms of your particular role?
Yeah, the CFTC is, maybe I should take a step back for the listeners and describe again what the CFTC is. A lot of people have heard about it, but maybe they don't really know the full extent of what it does. So in the US is a little bit unique compared to other countries, because we split our financial regulator in half. In many countries, there's just one financial markets regulator that governs both the securities world and the derivatives or commodities world. For historical reasons and political reasons, the CFTC is separate from the SEC. And obviously, there are jurisdictional battles that go on between the two, and we can get into some of that later. But broadly speaking, the SEC regulates the securities markets, which is equities, stocks, bonds, investment contracts. And the CFTC regulates the derivatives market, which is notionally, it's actually a far bigger market. And it's super important to everything that goes on in the real world, from farmers growing corn, from Southwest and United Airlines being able to price and afford jet fuel, to interest rates and other financial commodities. It's so important for people to have tools to manage risk for their day-to-day business activities. And so the CFTC regulates all those markets. CFTC stands for Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So the joke is futures are our middle name. And because of that, the CFTC's jurisdiction is limited. It only regulates and that's an important word. It only regulates futures, options, swaps, and retail commodity transactions, which in something called retail forex. But those are the four big categories. It has some authority over spot commodity. So spot means commodities traded on a cash, fully paid basis. So if you walk into a store and you buy a banana, that's a spot transaction, banana for cash. If you walk up to a barge full of grain and you spend $1 million to buy that barge full of grain, that also is a spot transaction. It's a commodity for cash. Same thing if you buy $1 million of Bitcoin. That transaction is not regulated by the CFTC, meaning there's no rules that the CFTC writes for that. There's no registrations needed. You don't have to register in any capacity to be a spot trader in a commodity like Bitcoin. But the CFTC does have fraud and manipulation jurisdiction over spot transactions and commodities in certain cases. There's some limitations to that, broadly speaking. So a Ponzi scheme involving Bitcoin or Ethereum, the CFTC would have jurisdiction over that, but they couldn't write rules governing the cash market. So big picture, you know, what the CFTC really looks for are people offering derivatives or derivative-like products in crypto, or they're looking for people doing fraud and manipulation involving crypto. That's the sort of the broad outlines of what the CFTC jurisdiction is.
One thing I want to ask you is, you mentioned there were like political reasons and some other reasons for this split between the SEC and the CFTC when it comes to who governs what aspect. Are you familiar with those? Like, why did it evolve this way? Whereas in Canada, for example, in many other countries, there's just one regulator that governs both.
Yeah, I don't know the whole story. I think it has to do in part with the power of the farmers' lobby. And in the U.S., the fact that the Senate and House Ag Committee wanted to supervise its own industry, essentially. I think that's part of it. The other part, I think, is historically, the commodities markets grew up separate from the Wall Street, essentially. And they really started in Chicago, or where I live and where I'm from. And we have great markets like the CME and CBOT here in Chicago. And it really started in the 1800s with farmers coming together in Chicago to make markets for their commodities. So there's lots of books written on it, but I don't remember all the details, but there is a schism in the U.S. among practitioners and markets in terms of the securities world and the commodities world. You're seeing a lot of that now in Congress with the proposals where CFTC has its backers and in terms of lawmakers who want to give more power to the CFTC. And then similarly, the SEC is its own lobby as well.
And I guess when you encapsulate all the derivatives trading, that's a huge market. And even the definition of what a derivative is can be really interesting to unpack. Like, when you think of a derivative, and particularly in the sense of crypto, what do you mean by that? Or what comes to mind is where that jurisdiction ends, or just what that definition encompasses?
Yeah, that's true. I think if you want to do like the building blocks of the CFTC's jurisdiction, the place you need to start is, what is a commodity? Because the CFTC only has jurisdiction over commodities. And again, it's been famously said that the definition of a commodity is really broad. It is quite broad. And the definition governs, there's enumerated agricultural commodities, but it also has really broad language in Section 1A of the Commodity Exchange Act. And it includes, quote, all services, rights, and interests in which contracts for future delivery are presently or in the future dealt in. It's a very broad definition. Unpacking that a little bit, it's a little bit circular. Anything on which a futures contract is based is by definition a commodity, but it also includes broad range of financial products and interest rates, for example, or commodity securities or commodities, but they're excluded from the CFTC's jurisdiction. So it's very broad. What is not a commodity is things that are not fungible. A specific baseball card is not a commodity because it's not a bulk thing that's interchangeable with something else. A car is not a commodity. A specific bilateral contract between two people itself could not be a commodity. But in terms of the CFTC has taken the position, and federal courts have agreed that Bitcoin is a commodity, Ethereum is a commodity. And those positions, I think, are strengthened by the fact that you have CFTC approved futures contracts trading in both those products. The CFTC has taken the position that stable coins are commodities. Now, the SEC had taken the same position. Think about that a little bit. The CFTC had taken the position that crypto assets that are like Bitcoin or Ethereum are commodities as well. So I think if you're operating in the space, it's a safe assumption to make that pretty much any fungible digital asset is going to be considered a commodity. Where it's much more unclear are things like NFTs. The CFTC, I don't believe, has brought a case involving NFTs to date. They would have a hard time doing that. And for every other sort of typical cryptocurrency or stablecoin or digital asset, that would probably be considered to be a commodity.
So interesting that stablecoins are thought of in that regard, because in Canada, they're saying they're either a security or derivative, but we're in charge of them in some manner. And I'm surprised they didn't go the derivative path for stablecoins. It's rather itself a commodity.
Yeah, that's right. So now I guess that leads to the question of what is a derivative? Under the Commodity Exchange Act, there's really like three flavors of derivatives. And then there's one other thing, which is a retail commodity transaction. There's futures contracts, there's options, and there's swaps. The futures contracts are not defined in the statute itself, nor are options. And swap has one of the broadest definitions of all time, actually. In general, a futures contract is an agreement to buy or sell a particular commodity or asset or security at a predetermined price at a specified time in the future. You know, the purpose of a futures contract is risk management. And you have to remember how they grew up over time. So futures contracts started with a farmer wanting to limit his risk and not be subject to the swings in the corn market or soybean market. And so they would sell off all or a portion of their harvest at a specified price in the future. Futures markets and futures contracts really developed around the need for sellers of commodities to have certainty and be able to manage their risk. And same thing for buyers to be able to do the same thing and offset risk. And standing in between the two were speculators, people who were able to supply liquidity to the markets. And so those three functions of people who are hedging risk and speculating, hedging both on the buy side and the sell side, are what make up a healthy, well-functioning market. And in order for there to be a real sort of need for hedging, there needs to be an actual business use need in order to have real price risk in something. You know, when I think of what that looks like for in the U.S., so in the U.S., there's regulated futures contracts on only Ethereum and Bitcoin. And I think that makes some sense, because if you're a Bitcoin miner, you have real price risk. You're burning electricity. You're investing in software and hardware in order to mine Bitcoin. And the product that you're producing is fluctuating in value. And there is a real need for you, although many of them don't. Many of my clients don't manage their risk in the futures market. But there's a real need for you to hedge your risk in the futures market. And same thing for many market participants who are buying and selling Bitcoin and Ethereum, need a way to manage their price risk. So certain things are treated like, I guess to go back to the Bitfinex example, unlike securities, where two people can trade private securities back and forth without any kind of registration or license. That's not true for derivatives. Congress made the determination that because futures contracts are typically traded with margin, and there's the risk of liquidation and margin calls, and because farmers and retail participants in the past have gotten very badly burned trading in derivatives, it is illegal in the U.S. to transact in derivatives contracts without being registered with the CFTC and fully regulated. So that is a big difference between the securities world and the CFTC.
And so that ties in perfectly to the sort of one of the big things I wanted to talk to you about, which is the CFTC's history involving crypto. Everyone talks about the SEC, but where did the CFTC's crypto intermixing start? Was it with that 2018 consumer protection or customer protection advisory that warned consumers to beware of and avoid pump and dump schemes, or was it something a bit before that?
It started, I think, around 20, I can't remember the date, it was either 2014 or 2015, where you had people in the US that were offering futures contracts on Bitcoin, and they were letting people speculate here in the US on cash settled futures contract. I think the first case was either an option or futures on Bitcoin. I think the case that I brought, Bitfinex, was I think the third case. And what Bitfinex was doing was they weren't explicitly offering futures contracts, but they were allowing people to buy and sell coin on margin. So on a financed or leveraged basis, which Congress, it's section 2C2D of the Act, Congress says, we're going to treat that just like a futures contract because it effectively amounts to the same thing. It's just another way of speculating on margin on a commodity. And those were the CFTC's first. I mean, I think stepping back, if you look at the difference between the SEC and the CFTC has always been, I think, is a little bit more of a pro-technology, pro-innovation agency. Mm-hmm. And from the beginning, they've said, look, we are open to allowing market participants to trade in derivatives on crypto, but it has to be done in a regulated way pursuant to our rules. And unlike what the SEC has done, it's allowed that. I couldn't tell you exactly when the first approved futures contracts on Bitcoin started on the CME, but it was early. For many, many years, those have been functioning in the U.S. So there is a way to do it in a path that now Coinbase has succeeded in walking down. We can get into that later.
Let's go into the Bitfinex case. And so they were found to have operated a futures commission merchant without registering as required. So maybe you could start with explaining what a futures commission merchant is and does and why that's important, and then dive into the background of the case.
Yeah, like I said, there's no regulation of spot markets, but there's an intricate regulatory scheme if you're going to be trading in derivatives. And every link in the chain between the retail customer and the exchange itself, there's a different license that you need to get, essentially. People that interact with customers that take orders for trading in derivatives, typically you're an FCM, futures commission merchant. You need that license in order to accept cash or make loans or lend in order for people to trade. That's one of the ways customers face markets is through an FCM. And then you go all the way down to the hardest and biggest license to get is a DCM, designated contract market, which is the heavily regulated entities like CME and CBOT, analogous to like a securities exchange. But and in between there are clearing firms and there are other sort of intermediaries that guarantee trades that ensure that there's no, that every trade is backed up and there's no busted trades or defaults along the way. And the system that's been built up in traditional finance has led to, a pretty robust system over time. Very, very few defaults. It almost never ever happens here in the US where somebody enters into a futures contract and there's a failure of settlement at the end of the day or a bankruptcy.
What would be the difference then, Mike, between an FCM and a DCM in terms of what you're able to do with that license? Like, I could guess at what some of the things may be when you just look at the CME compared to something like a Coinbase, but what would be some of the substantial differences?
Broadly speaking, if you're an FCM, you can interact with customers, you can take orders, you can be the party that goes out and solicits people for trading, and you're the touch point between the retail customer and the futures market. The DCM is the actual centralized exchange that creates order books, lists contracts for sale. If a list comes up and gets approval from the CFTC or the NFA to list a new contract or a new product. And Coinbase now is both. So Coinbase acquired a DCM.
Was that Fairex?
Yes. And now they rebranded to the Coinbase Derivatives Exchange. So they're trying, they have launched their own products. They have a Bitcoin and an Ethereum institutional size futures contract. Now they're offering smaller ones. They call them nano contracts to retail customers. So yes, they have a centralized derivatives exchange. And then now with this new FCM license that they got, they can themselves enter the retail market and start to offer these products to their customers, the big transaction. So this is, definitely it's a big area. The CFTC's sort of main interest in crypto right now, frankly, is going after large centralized exchanges that are targeting U.S. customers like Binance. That's what that case was about. DeFi platforms that are operating in the U.S. and being offered to U.S. customers. So that's the core.
And when you say offered to U.S. customers, does that just mean accessible, or is there any element of reverse solicitation, or what does that look like?
Yeah, that's the trick. So what does it mean to be operating or offered to U.S. customers? There's not a lot of law on this at all. I think everybody would agree that this extent of the U.S. law doesn't reach around the entire world, right?
Right.
But if you're operating a DeFi protocol that is living on the blockchain and is accessible to anybody with an internet connection, does that mean that, what does it mean to be allow offering the trading to U.S. customers? I think that there's a lot of uncertainty and lack of clarity on that point, I think.
Okay. Okay. So not too similar to most jurisdictions where it is. Yeah. It's a difficult question. And I think until we start to see some cases brought, we've even seen some cases where they've argued that because the majority of the economic activity takes place in the U.S. or the nodes are based in the U.S., like there's with DeFi, it will be really interesting. But now let's talk about the Coinbase announcement. So they have their FCM registration or license. And so what does that mean for Coinbase now? And you alluded to a bit earlier about the retail facing, but wondering if you could just explain what's happened with Coinbase and why this was so important and frankly, why it took so long, given that they began speaking with them
on these huge inaccessible platforms where U.S. market participants don't get access. And I don't think that's good for markets generally, and I don't think that's good for Americans. The U.S. gets a lot of its strength as a leader in financial markets by having big, open, safe places for U.S. users to come and trade. And I think the fact now that Coinbase is a DCM, is offering their own contracts and is able to tap into their reach to extend regulated products to U.S. users is going to be good for crypto in general. And it's going to be good for market too. It's also unfair because a lot of today, if you want to trade crypto derivatives, you're limited to, there's a few contracts on CME, Bitcoin, and Ethereum. But if you want to do anything else, you can't. As an individual person in the U.S., it's illegal and very difficult practically to get an account on one of these offshore derivatives exchanges. And if you're an institutional trader, one of the big hedge funds or prop shops, then you're going to have an offshore entity and an offshore office that you're able to trade through. And the practical effect of that is that financed, wealthy trading shops have the ability to access markets where regular retail people don't. So this is a step in the right direction, I think, to opening up market and providing more choice to people. So it's a good thing.
Okay, well, glad to hear that. And so Coinbase's offering now will change slightly now that they can offer this to U.S. customers. So now they can get regulated derivatives products through Coinbase Financial Markets. And you mentioned what this could mean to the crypto market, which I think is important. But you also mentioned the offshore options, right? And that plays a big role. And I'm sure the U.S. competitiveness as well as just what's safest for U.S. customers. And so what does the offshore market for crypto derivatives look like and how has that evolved over time?
Yeah, it's huge. It's absolutely astronomically huge. Binance, Deribit, a lot of DeFi venues that with more and more propping up every day. And like I said, it's a huge share of the market as well. And for price discovery purposes and for liquidity purposes, I just don't think it's a good thing that so much of the U.S. is closed off to everything that's going on there. And the choices are to broaden offerings in the U.S. or to allow U.S. market traders to access offshore market, which I don't see happening anytime soon. I think that, again, that leads to what's happening with Coinbase is a good thing. We'll lead to more adoption here in the U.S. over time.
And those offshore exchanges, they're able to offer products to U.S.-based institutions due to certain exemptions from the rules that exist for those types of institutions, types of traders?
Not really. A lot of the big hedge funds and trading firms will have an offshore entity to trade through. And so that's how they typically access those markets.
Right. So it's their own entity back to back, and then they can make the trades through there. So it's not like the U.S. company making the trade. It's the U.S. company trading with its own counterparty.
Yeah. Or it's like a, you know, an offshore affiliate of a big trading firm that has its own P&L. But again, the rules there are unclear as well. If you read between the lines, the CFTC has not yet sued like a big US-based trading firm for trading offshore on some of these offshore exchanges. But you know, like in the Binance complaint, for example, there was a bunch of like unnamed trading firm one, unnamed trading firm two. The implication is, and the CFTC made some allegations about this trading firm had some of the traders were in the U.S. and the strategies were developed in the U.S. and they relied on U.S. counsel, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it was a bit of a shot across the bow to the U.S. trading community. Okay, you better be careful. if you're going to do this, you got to do it right. The days of having a post office box in Panama, you know, being enough to have an account at Deribit are long gone. So I think what that means, again, in practice is only the big, well-capitalized international firms are the ones that can access these markets from the US, which is not a good thing, in my view.
Not a good thing for the markets, not a good thing for equity as well. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any prior attempts that were made to expand crypto derivatives for retail. What happened and what were the outcomes?
So the last kind of big milestone in this journey was one that was kicked off by good old Sam Bankman-Fried. So last spring, FTX US had acquired an entity, LedgerX, which had a DCO license, a derivatives clearing organization license, that was trying to, under their proposal, they would not clear their trades through an FCM, but instead they would offer access directly. So rather than going through an FCM, and again, this is not an issue with Coinbase anymore because they themselves have been registered as an FCM, customers would go into FTX US and be able to access derivatives. It took a line of protection. Remember earlier I said, one of the things about the design of the derivatives industry in the US is there are many sort of levels that protect against failure, bulwarks against failure. And one of those levels is the FCM. The FCM guarantees trades from retail participants. FTX at the time had set up, they had arguments about why an FCM wasn't necessary. They had a big fund set up to guarantee trades. They had their arguments about how great they are liquidating positions quickly and auto liquidation features that made its positions, you know, couldn't get out of balance. And they had this big proposal where they were proposing to announce this sort of new and innovative way to bring more retail participants into the derivatives market. So the CFTC actually took it pretty seriously. They didn't shoot it down out of hand. And they had a big series of public comments. A couple organizations that I'm part of submitted letters. They had a big public roundtable process. There were even hearings in Congress about it. And it was, a lot of people were for and against it. Obviously, like the big traditional institutional players like the CME were very against it, talking about how the traditional models of customer protection had functioned so well for a really long time. And ultimately, this whole thing got withdrawn after FTX blew up. And some of the concerns, frankly, from people like the CME were, you know, prescient after everything fell apart. But again, I think it's hard to imagine the SEC taking a request like this and treating it the same way. The CFTC didn't dismiss it out of hand just because it was crypto. Who knows if it would have gotten approved, FTX hadn't been a fraud, but there was a public comment period. The request was taken seriously and they really thought about, is it a good thing to have more from a public policy perspective to have easier and more ample access to derivatives markets? Is that a good thing for us to do? But a lot of people ended up having egg on their face because of what happened with Mr. Bankman-Fried.
Yes. So. A lot of people outside the regulators as well, too, yeah. As inside, I'm sure, in Congress and a lot of people just in general. I wanted to ask about, do you think anything like this could actually happen going forward if there is someone that pushes it and gets some weight behind it? Or is this current system more likely to stick around?
That's a good question. What I think a lot about is how do we make room for experimentation and innovation in financial markets that are regulated by the CFTC, especially on concerns like DeFi. So I've got a lot of clients who saying, look, I want to do direct peer-to-peer trading of futures and options products on the blockchain using smart contracts. And how do I come in and register? How do I do it? And there really is no path right now. And there's no clear mechanism for this type of derivatives trading to happen in the US. I think a lot of people are talking about this. How do we approach the CFTC for exemptive relief? Or how do we change the laws to allow for DeFi to enable different models of trading that don't have some of the same risks that traditional futures trading has? And so that's the next frontier, is how do we allow for that here in the US?
And when you say they're unable to go in register right now in the traditional path, I think we all in this space take it for granted why, but what are some of the main reasons why it's untenable for existing projects?
Yeah, it's just a lot of the rules and regulations, like what you need to, so again, like the, if you're the venue on which trading happens, then you're a DCM or a VCO, DCM. Right. And there are, right. It's a principle. If you look at the rule book for what is required in order to get registered as a DCM, you got to have policies and procedures. It's like a whole crazy infrastructure that's designed to be, it just doesn't compute. It doesn't mesh at all into what a blockchain-based system that operates by human intervention would have. So there really is no way currently. And if you look at the law, you know, all the various legislative proposals in Congress, no one is trying to tackle this in Congress yet. There's no clear legislative fix on the table to enable this kind of experimentation.
That's one thing I wanted to ask. And I remember the question I was blanking on now is the difference in approaches between the SEC and CFTC. I think you've done a great job of alluding to the differences, Mike, in terms of just what we've seen. But why do you think the CFTC is more willing to discuss? Like, how is the CFTC structured? Because a lot of people attribute the SEC's approach to Chair Gensler and how he can set the agenda and all the power he has there. Is there an equivalent at the CFTC in terms of how it's structured?
The legal structure is very comparable. There's commissioners appointed by Democrats and Republicans. It operates somewhat the same way. But I don't know. Historically, the culture has been like less political, less partisan, more practical. And like the derivatives industry has always been more pro-technology. If you look at, even in my lifetime, you saw the transition from pit trading, like Eddie Murphy, and trading places, everyone waving their hands at each other, to high-frequency futures trading. And that transition happened in the securities world too, but it was really embraced by the CFTC in an efficient way. And the CFTC always talks about how, I don't know how true it is, but they talk about how they're technology neutral, and they have tried in the past to make space for new technologies. But it's still a big, maybe, I think it's less bureaucratic. Yeah, it's, I think, at least in the enforcement division where I work, like a tenth the size of the SEC's. So decisions can be made a little faster. And I think the CFTC is closer to market in some ways than the SEC is. But it's still a government agency and government bureaucracy. And it's also still limited by what the law says and what the Commodity Exchange Act says. And right now, there's not a lot of clear guidance on how, especially DeFi, can be adopted and how more innovative peer-to-peer modes of trading implemented here in the U.S. So I think that's the next area of focus.
Okay. And I know we're starting to see a lot of proposals, and I've heard the Agriculture Committee and that they're involved. Is there anything you're particularly keeping an eye on or excited about or see has potential going forward out of the legislative initiatives that are underway at this time?
Yeah, obviously, if I had to pick a regulator for crypto markets in the U.S., I think the CFTC would be a better fit. But it would be a big lift for any agency, but for the CFTC in particular, to get jurisdiction over the spot markets. Right now, I mean, for the CFTC to write rules for Coinbase, for Gemini and the other spot exchanges, it would be a huge lift. And it would require a lot more funding, a lot of time, but I'd rather have the CFTC performing their oversight role versus the SEC, I would think. But who knows what's going to happen?
I think a lot of people share that sentiment.
Yeah, who knows what's going to happen? I don't know.
Yeah. Good point too about how like the CFTC, really, you think back to the creation of like the SEC and what the circumstances were around that, couched in consumer protection versus CFTC. It's much more, how do we help businesses navigate these areas with a consumer protection ideal as well, but a bit of a different sort of foundation.
I think that's right. I think one of the problems with what Chair Gensler is doing is if you define investment contract as broadly as he is, then it basically takes the entire industry and says, this is illegal. And if you look at the Commodity Exchange Act, there's light or no regulation of commodities in interstate commerce. So you have to, there's essentially what the law says is if you stay away from derivatives, leverage, swaps, then, you know, that you can go forth and do business as long as you don't do fraud or market manipulation. And when you're talking about a new industry here with so much potential to change the way people interact online and how value is exchanged and how organizations like DAOs develop up. Obviously, I think a lighter touch is the way to go, as opposed to basically waving your wand and saying that the entire industry is illegal.
Yep. Very reasonable, Mike. No, that makes complete sense. Thanks for really like a masterclass on the CFTC and the commodities rules and everything too. It'll be interesting to see how that dynamic unfolds over the next couple of years. Like, do you have any predictions on where you see things landing with regards to the jurisdiction of the CFTC versus the SEC when it comes to something like a crypto platform?
My prediction is, for people who think the SEC is going to get displaced out of these markets and the CFTC is going to take over, I don't think that's going to happen. I think the best outcome here would be a carving up of the industry into some way, shape, or form. I think the banking regulators are a more natural regulator of stablecoins. Mm-hmm. I think they should get jurisdiction over stablecoins, frankly. I think that there's going to be some mechanism where the SEC and the CFTC collaborate and decide whether an asset is a security or if it's a commodity. And trading crypto commodities hopefully would fall under the CFTC's jurisdiction. But one thing that scares me is, in the absence of federal action on this, you're starting to see the states propose all kinds of goofy things. Illinois almost passed a bill earlier this year that would have broadly regulated digital asset activity in the state. California is considering a bill right now. New Jersey has a bill that has been, you know, all put on the verge of passing a number of times. So we really need some action in the federal level, or else it's just going to be a patchwork quilt of regulation. It's going to be really hard for the industry to navigate, I think.
And I know you played a large role in Illinois in moving that initiative forward. So thank you for that, because I'm sure that was a huge lift. Oh, I remember seeing all the work that you're doing just in the
general. Yeah, luckily we were able to convince the lawmakers here in Illinois to hold off and rethink things. But it's quite possible we'll see a bill like that again. And it's clear that there's coordination among the big states to regulate the industry. We'll see what happens. And listen, I'm pro-regulation. I think this industry needs like smart, common sense regulation. And so people know where the rules of the road are. I think every serious person and every serious lawyer is begging for it, frankly. And it also is like a be careful what you wish for. You just might get a situation.
Yeah. I know. It's so true. And the regulators here said all stablecoins are securities and you have to get consent from us. Mm-hmm. And so one of the counter arguments is, you know, sure, you can regulate them as stable or as securities, but it's probably better to have it in something like consumer protection measures, like gift cards and PayPal balance, like things like that. But that might even be more onerous when you apply those rules. But imagine how much more enjoyable the whole legal experience would be if you could say, okay, that's a really interesting idea. Here's the rules that apply to you. Here's how they operate in this state. Here's what we'll need to do next.
For sure. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It seems like to me like Canada is more friendly than the U.S., but maybe that's just an outsider's perspective.
We're a lot less litigious than the U.S., and I think we're a lot friendlier in the sense where they didn't begin going after platforms like you've seen in the U.S. It was a lot more of come in and talk to us. We're just a bit more conservative in terms of taking risks and trying not to be the first in many circumstances. And I feel for the regulators. They didn't ask for this industry to spring out. They're not only doing this, they're doing everything else as well. But it's an easier jurisdiction for platforms to navigate and for projects to just think through, particularly if you're offering some sort of trading platform. But it is complicated because the regulators are timid in terms of sticking their neck out and granting exemptive relief for any novel proposals. Things just spun out of Quadriga. After Quadriga collapsed, it was, how do we reduce this counterparty?
In a lot of ways, though, I feel like the trading of digital assets, whether spot or derivatives, is like the least interesting thing going on in the space. It's important, and people need to have markets and secondary markets, and people need access and be able to manage the risk. But it's to me, what's actually going to change the world is DAOs and organizing activity online and transferring value and becoming an owner of a platform or a tool as opposed to a consumer of it or of the product yourself. I think these markets are necessary, but ideally financial regulators would stay out of the way and let builders build. And I think that's the most interesting thing. And when people come to me and say, I want to do a new derivatives trading platform. That's fine. And that's important work. And I'm happy to like talk to them. But it's much more interesting when a project comes to me and says, here's a problem. I think this is really going to, the blockchain can solve this in a real way, in a material way. And here's what I think. So anyway.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think it's the solving problems, right? I think the problem of how do you trade your crypto has been solved many over. And, you know, we don't need many new solutions there. It's what are the other things that are happening in the off-chain world and Web2 that can solve for. And that was
and imagine if like there. Federal financial regulators were like so in the weeds of everything that was going on in the early internet days. And here, so it really is like we should stay out of the way as much as possible and let innovators innovate and entrepreneurs do their thing.
Yep. No, 100%. Last question for you, Mike, regarding your career and some advice and habits. Like, are there any habits that you've cultivated or you've brought into your legal practice that have helped you cultivate a successful career?
Gosh, that's a hard one. Really, like curiosity and always learning and reading is, for me, so important. I don't know about you, but I probably spend a significant chunk of the day reading articles, getting deep into projects and understanding what's going on and trying to learn new things. That's, to me, that's what's so fun about it. I've always been like a generalist because I feel like I would just get bored if I picked like one narrow area of the law and became focused on that exclusively. I think being a well-rounded lawyer and learning everything you can about what's going on in the space is so important.
And it's so easy when you're curious rather than when you're forced to read something. It's just you actually enjoy going through it and you want to find the answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me today. This is great. I really enjoyed it.
No, my pleasure, Mike. And thanks for joining me. Really appreciate the masterclass on the CFTC and enjoy the fishing trip.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay. Talk to you later.